snow, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 12 noon. Stay tuned next for Living Room.
Good afternoon and welcome to Living Room. I'm your host, Chris Welch. Coming up on this, the 14th of August, 2015, we're going to be talking about Katrina, the aftermath in New Orleans. 10 years later, the anniversary of that is coming right up. And then we also have some wonderful performers and good news of stuff coming in. Filmmaker William Farley has a brand new film out, and Country Joe McDonald is out in the hall. And I hope that Emily Yates will be joining him soon, all coming in to talk to you right after news headlines with Eileen Alfandary.
Secretary of State John Kerry said today that talks with Cuba on full normalization of ties will start in mid-September. Kerry made the announcement after attending a ceremonial raising of the U.S. flag over the restored U.S. embassy in Havana.
We are all aware that notwithstanding President Obama's new policy, the overall U.S. embargo on trade with Cuba remains in place and can only be lifted by congressional action, a step that we strongly favor. For now,
the move to fully lift the U.S. trade embargo against Cuba is bitterly opposed by some Republicans. Speaking in New York, Republican Florida Senator and presidential candidate Marco Rubio slammed President Obama and Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, for their policies on Iran and Cuba.
Cuban dissidents have fought for decades for the very democratic principles President Obama claims to be advancing through these concessions. Their exclusion from this event has ensured it will be little more than a propaganda rally for the Castro regime. So I will make this pledge here and now, as president, as a symbol of our solidarity between my administration and those who strive for freedom around the world. I will invite Cuban dissidents, Iranian dissidents, Chinese dissidents, and freedom fighters from all around the world to be honored guests at my inauguration.
Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez said Cuba's claims for damages caused by the long U.S. economic embargo must be considered at the same time as U.S. claims for property expropriated by the Cuban government. Each side estimates its claims run well into the billions of dollars. Speaking through a translator, Rodriguez ticked off other issues that must be resolved in negotiations with the U.S.
Discussed with the Secretary of State that total lifting of the embargo, in our view, is absolutely essential to be able to have normal relations between the countries, and as well as the territory that's been usurped from our country in the on our territory in Guantanamo Bay.
Kerry said one thing not on the table is the naval base at Guantanamo. The U.S. continues to hold foreign detainees there without charge from the so-called war on terror. Oakland activists plan to stage a vigil this evening at the spot where 24-year-old African-American man was shot and killed by Oakland police Wednesday night. Police Chief Sean Wentz says police shot the man after a car chase and as he was advancing towards officers while holding a pistol in his hand. But speaking on KPFA, Kat Brooks, founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project, says that's not what witnesses told members of her group when they arrived on the scene shortly after the fatal shooting.
And we got conflicting reports from witnesses about whether or not he had a gun. That said, what we got from all witnesses, whether they thought the police did the right thing or not, was that he was running, he was in the process of surrendering, and he was shot in the back. So this business about there was a confrontation or that he was walking toward officers, we know for a fact that that's just lies. They're just lies. It didn't happen.
The man died shortly after the shooting. Police have said he was an armed robbery suspect. It was the third fatal shooting by Oakland police this year. A woman who shot a video that shows a Miami police officer jumping on top of a handcuffed teenager in a patrol car says the teen was asking why he was being arrested. The incident happened yesterday afternoon in Miami's Liberty City neighborhood. Shinitria Blocker said the officer said he didn't have to tell the teen why he was being arrested. Then she says the officer jumped into the car and hit the teen a couple of times. Blocker says another officer asked her to stop recording and tried to take her phone away. A Miami police spokesperson said the department has reviewed the video and launched an investigation. He said the officer turned in his badge and gun and will be taken off the streets until the investigation wraps up. Eurozone officials are optimistic of approving a draft bailout deal for Greece today. The Greek parliament itself passed the deal after an all-night, often contentious debate. The vote in the parliament was 222 yes, 64 no, and 11 abstentions. Although it was approved by a comfortable majority, the result was a blow to Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. He saw more than 40 of his 149 Syriza party lawmakers vote against the deal. I'm Eileen Alfandari. News returns with headlines at 4. Please join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
Welcome back to Living Room. I'm Chris Welch. Coming up later in the program, I'm thrilled to say filmmaker, Bay Area filmmaker, and artist and treasurer William Farley will be joining us. His latest film is about another Bay Area artist and treasurer, namely Jerry Ross Barish. The name of it is Plastic Man, and seeing it yesterday introduced me to this gentleman's life and work, and I'm the better for it, and you'll enjoy it as well. We're also going to hear from Country Joe McDonald about the protest song convention that's taking place tomorrow. And I hope that Emily Yates is going to be joining him. I heard her and him the other night at the Berkeley Barb's 50th anniversary, and Emily killed it. Of course, so did Joe, but he's a pro, been doing it longer, and she was fabulous. I never heard her before. She's really cool, so I hope she shows up. And if you want to hear her, you'll get to see her tomorrow for sure, even if she doesn't show up today. But we begin with an anniversary, another anniversary that's coming up. August 29th, 2005 was when Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf coast. 10 years later, we are being joined on the telephone by Jordan Flaherty, award-winning journalist, producer, and author. He lived and worked in New Orleans, and he wrote the book Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6, which he also covered, and he continues to work in that vein, and we're very glad that he took some time out to join us on the phone. Good afternoon to you, Jordan.
Good afternoon, Chris. It's such a pleasure to be on again.
There is an interview posted at the Associated Press, and it got posted in the New York Times, with Mayor Mitch Landrieu, and he says, everything's groovy, we're moving in the right direction, property values are going up, not to worry. We've got to ask ourselves whether the city was perfect the day before the storm or whether or not we had problems. Bill Quigley, of course, a professor and civil rights attorney at Loyola University in New Orleans, has a somewhat different assessment. What can you tell us about New Orleans here 10 years later?
Well, the city still has 100,000 less people than it did pre-Katrina. And in fact, parallel to that statistic, the city has almost exactly 100,000 less African Americans than it did pre-Katrina. So this disaster is definitely shaped along lines of race and gender as well. One of the main things that kept people from coming back were jobs and housing. And if you look at jobs, one of the big obstacles was the firing of the entire staff of the public school system, and that was mostly Black women. If you look at housing, one of the main things keeping people back was tearing down all of the public housing. And again, that was mostly Black women affected by that as well. That was the majority of the population with public housing. So both race and gender lines have really shaped people's recovery. And yes, you know, our mayor is calling this, I think his slogan is, the America's number one success story or something like that. But Rosanna Cruz, a local organizer here, refers to our mayor as the city's concierge in chief. And she says he's focusing much more on making things comfortable for the tourists and for people just moving here than for the longtime residents who created the culture that has made this city such a destination. Mm.
Of course, tourism as well as oil and gas development are two of the largest sectors of the city's economy. You can't make a lot of money serving the tourist industry, really most folks, most jobs down there. And, of course, that there were tens of billions of dollars of relief money that came into the city. Where did that go?
Yeah, that's a great question. So people are adding it up as about $71 billion of federal money. One big chunk of that went to the state-administered program called the Road Home Program, which gave money to homeowners. So right away, that cut out renters and homeless folks, and you know, and anyone that wasn't a homeowner was cut out from that major program. And then even within homeowners, that program years later was found by a judge to be racially discriminatory. The way it gave out money was based on property values. So you could have two homes, the same square footage, the same year, the same amount of damage, the same cost to repair. But if you lived in a white neighborhood, you got about 40% more money than if you lived in a black neighborhood. And that's how it panned out around the city on average. Mm. White homeowners got about 40% more money than black homeowners. So if you weren't a homeowner, you got no money. But even if you were a homeowner, if you were a black homeowner, you got tens of thousands of less money from that. Some of the other money was spent on the levies. We certainly do have better levies than we did before. Has enough been done? You know, part of the issue is it's not just about levies. It's about the wetlands. And, you know, you mentioned the oil and gas industry. It was the oil and gas industry that destroyed the wetlands of the city. We lose about a football field of land every hour from the wetlands, quickly going away. And about 40% of that is directly because of these canals that the oil and gas industry dug to dig their wells that brings, salt water into these freshwater marshes and destroys them. So, you know, you have massive damage to the city that's coming from these wetlands being eroded away, and the state refuses, you know, especially Governor Jindal refuses to hold the oil and gas industry accountable. One other thing I want to say on the tourism industry, you know, you rightly point out that it's hard to make money in the tourism industry, but I will say, you know, many of these same hotels that are in New Orleans paying people minimum wage, that same chain is in Las Vegas paying people several times more, you know, partly because they had a union in Vegas and they did fight for it, you know. So it's possible in Vegas to be a housekeeper, and support a hotel and support a middle class lifestyle for a family of three. That's something that's not possible in New Orleans. And again, these hotels are really exploiting the people by paying the least they possibly can for the work that people do.
Hmm. Jordan Flaherty, our guest on the phone, print and other journalist. He's reported for Al Jazeera America, Al Jazeera English, etc. He's also been on NPR and Fox and all kinds of places. His book about this particular topic is Floodlines, and we're very happy he could join us on the phone here. 10-year anniversary coming up. Lest we forget, almost 2,000 people were killed and more than $150 billion in damage reported to have been done to New Orleans alone, much less the rest of the Gulf, as you're pointing out. That was another Associated Press story today about just what you're talking about. The levees got a new $14.5 billion protection system built in, but beyond the levees, all of those little towns are drifting away at an average of 17 square miles a year, disappearing, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. And they say that most scientists said that it was because of the destruction to those wetlands that Katrina was so
catastrophic in its attack on New Orleans in the first place. But what I'm remembering is, of course, the images of all of those folks left behind on the roofs of their houses waiting for rescue, and then all of the folks that were that fled to Houston and elsewhere, and all they wanted was to come home, including here in the Bay Area, all they wanted was to go home. What do we know about how many people have made it home to New Orleans?
Yeah, and you know, when you talk about those images, one of the things I think about, you know, I moved to New Orleans a few years before Hurricane Katrina, and I evacuated a few days after the storm. I went through an evacuee camp just outside of town, and you know, I saw National Guard soldiers pointing guns at children. I saw families getting separated as they were put on buses. People weren't even told where the bus would be going, or in some cases, we later found out, people were even put on planes, and they weren't even told where the plane was going. The bus were taken to the airport, and then they were just put on planes, and people ended up in, I believe, 48 states.
This is largely, these are black folks that we're talking about.
Right. I mean, certainly in the evacuee camp that I was in, it was about 95% African American, and overall, that's who, you know, didn't have the money to be able to evacuate. The city was, of course, majority African American already, and then those that didn't have the money to evacuate were disproportionately African American. So yes, those that were spread unwillingly across the country, that weren't able to evacuate themselves and put themselves in a hotel room just outside of town, you know, they were disproportionately African American. And then, you know, even within equally damaged neighborhoods, you know, so for example, the Lower Ninth Ward is a working class African American neighborhood that was completely devastated in the storm, and Lakeview was a middle to upper class white neighborhood that was completely devastated during the storm. But for months, residents of the Lower Ninth Ward were not even allowed to cross into the Lower Ninth Ward to even look at their home, while within a couple of weeks, residents of Lakewood were allowed to go back to their homes, were allowed to start rebuilding. And so you had people in the Lakeview neighborhood already with trailers set up outside their house doing repairs on their house, while people from the Lower Ninth Ward were not even allowed into their neighborhood. So good disproportionate recovery. And then if you look at the way the class and race affected the rebuilding process, you know, people, everyone had problems with their insurance companies and with the road home program. But, you know, people in the Lakeview neighborhood, when they saw that their insurance company was giving them problems, they, you know, had enough money in the bank that they could start doing repairs themselves. They could hire a lawyer to help them deal with the insurance company. And again, they could begin the process of moving back. People in the Lower Ninth Ward that didn't have those resources, they didn't have their job, for example, in the school system anymore. When they saw that they were not getting paid off from their insurance company, you know, they didn't have the same options. They didn't have the money that they could just start rebuilding themselves. They didn't have the money that they could hire a lawyer to represent them.
Well, this
so, you know, they were cut out of that rebuilding process.
This is represented in the statistics that show that previous to Katrina, there were the population of New Orleans was 66.7% African American. Now it's down to 59%. White residency is up from 26 to 31. Hispanic up from 3 to 5.5. Meanwhile, white incomes, which before Katrina were twice that of blacks, have risen to three times as much as black. 55% of residents of New Orleans rent, and the rent is up 33% for one-bedroom apartments, 41% for two-bedrooms. 55% rent, the average nationally is only 35%. And then there's the children. You started out, you mentioned the schools. And, of course, New Orleans has 91% charter schools. This is the highest rate in the country. And 38% of the children in New Orleans lived in poverty pre-Katrina. Now it's up to 39%. The national average is 17%. And 50% of the black children live in those poorer households, which is a higher percentage than pre-Katrina. These are statistics compiled by Bill Quigley, and it's just how to go back to Mitch Landrieu, the mayor's comments about, well, was it perfect before the storm? How has it really changed all that much beyond a couple of percentage points in your view? It looks like it's much wider to begin with.
It's much wider. You know, if you look at those disparities, I think another really revealing statistic is the zip code just near me, encompassing parts of Mid-City and the Treme neighborhood, has a life expectancy of 54 years old, while the previously mentioned Lakeview neighborhood, mostly white neighborhood, has a life expectancy of 80 years. It's a 25-year of life expectancy difference, you know, in areas just a couple of miles apart. You know, I would also refer to what the writer and professor and activist Dean Spade would call distribution of life chances, right, of life opportunities, the options and opportunities that are available to people. And so, you know, New Orleans is, I think, still, you know, perhaps the most amazing city on earth. It's an incredible place with incredible music every day of the week. Every Sunday you have second lines, brass bands in the streets, huge dance parties in the streets. They're called second lines. You know, of course, you have all the Mardi Gras celebrations that go on for about a month here. Just so much food and culture and music that is beautiful and amazing. But the people that create that culture, the working class African American people, that have created and maintained this African Caribbean culture that has made this city so special, are the ones that have been cut out and have been left out of the recovery.
Amen. Jordan, I thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join us today. And I wondered what you would suggest people can do. I know there is a United Saints, www.unitedsaints.org. That's the United Saints Recovery Project. I don't know what else you could recommend to folks to keep informed and to be paying attention. Are there any issues that are up right now that people should know about?
Any particular political issues that are up right now?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, you know, I encourage people to my latest article on New Orleans and also a 25-minute film that I did on these issues are both up on the website of The Nation magazine this week. If you go to that, there's some other great coverage, too, and also the article will be in the newsstands next week in The Nation magazine. There's a whole tapestry of incredible organizations working here. The Congress of Day Laborers has over 400 active members coming to their weekly meetings. You have and they are part of the Workers Center for Racial Justice that also includes an organization called Stand with Dignity. You have the organization Breakout, which works with LGBTQ youth of color who are dealing with the prison industrial complex here. You have Women with a Vision that deals with issues and organizing around low-income black women in the city. So that is some of the really incredible organizations that are working here that I encourage people to support. In terms of the Katrina commemoration, there's a women of feminist black women led project called Eco Hybridity that is initiated by this woman Kai Barrow, who's one of the founders of Critical Resistance. And I can't say exactly the website, but if you look up Eco Hybridity, you should be able to find it. And that's a project that needs support and attention as well.
And before I let you go, what was the reaction in New Orleans to the events of Ferguson and for the whole rest of the year, all these police attacks on people of color, especially black folks?
Well, you know, New Orleans has a long history of police violence and of resistance to that police violence. This is, I think the only city in the country where we have two officers on death row for killing people. Of course, after Katrina, we had police really go on a shooting spree, killing nearly a dozen unarmed civilians in various attacks around the city. And after Ferguson, people actually marched into and took over a police station in the French Quarter. So you've really seen a revitalization of energy on that. There's the local chapter of the national organization BYP 100 is very active here in New Orleans, and they've been organizing on police violence as well as an end to the Confederate monuments that still fill our city.
Mm. Well, sir, I'm very grateful for your ongoing reporting. Jordan has produced award-winning fiction, films, documentaries, music videos, news reports. He's written books, and as he just mentioned, you can see his latest piece on this topic in the upcoming issue of The Nation magazine. Jordan Flaherty, our guest on the phone. Thank you so much, Jordan, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
Coming up, we're going to hear some talk about protest music that you can listen to, be part of. Don't go away. Welcome back. We have joining us in the studio two amazing performers, and coming up next is William Farley, who's out in the hall even as we speak to talk about his newest film, Plastic Man. Meanwhile, right here we have Country Joe McDonald, Berkeley, son of Berkeley, or no, son of Florence and Mac. How are you?
I'm fine. Fine.
Well, I saw you perform the other night. You were hysterical and also brilliant and the best guitar player, I must say, that appeared on the stage that evening.
Wow.
I've got to say.
I'll accept all those compliments, even though they're not true.
And an incredible storyteller. Now, that's definitely genetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was lovely about smoking bananas and
all kinds of stuff. Yum, yum.
So meanwhile, the last I spoke to you, I believe, was to promote this event, which is finally happening, what, tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yeah, from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Whoa. And so what's that?
Good response, yeah.
Well, that's a lot of stamina.
Well, it's 52 people at the moment, 10 minutes each, all doing some protest. Spoken word or song or comedy or whatever, but they only get 10 minutes.
And what was your thinking behind this? the call for this?
I'd been thinking about it for two or three years, that Berkeley should have a protest festival. Because Berkeley's noted for a city of protest, and I pitched it to the Unitarian Fellowship Cedar and Bonita Social Justice Committee, and what I had envisioned originally was not what happened at all, because originally I thought, well, there'd be some like headliners and it'd be like a folk festival, you know, like a festival. But we decided on the 10 minute thing, and in 2 weeks, we got 50 people. And then we started doing the math, trying to figure out, well, how do we handle this like herd of cats? 50 people, 10 minutes each. And I've done things before where if you run overtime in the beginning of it, it really messes you up in the end, because none of us wanted to be there till midnight. And I don't know how much you can stand of 50 people. Then we got in an argument amongst each other whether Kvetching was protesting or not. And some people said, no, protesting is serious. And Kvetching is like whining. And I thought, well, what's wrong with whining? It's a whining festival. Isn't protesting like just, you know, you could complain, you know, the lack of cheeseburgers in my neighborhood or something. I have not. Well, we'll see what happens. It's too late to stop now.
Oh, yeah. So this is at Cedar and Bonita in Berkeley, the protest festival. Cities in our listening area may want to consider putting on just such a thing.
And we decided to make it completely democratic in that everybody, performers pay $5 each. The audience pays $10 each. Nobody gets a free ride on this thing.
All right.
And we drew the order out of a hat, literally. We tore all the names up and we put them in a hat and we pulled it out. And your order was, you go on first, second, third, fourth. That's how it was determined, what time you go on.
Wow. Okay, so tomorrow, Friday, Saturday the 15th, which is my daughter's birthday.
Wow, how old is she going to be?
Dude.
Tell
35.
Me. 35. Wow, time flies.
How old is Tara?
Tara is about the same age.
Yeah, this is a test. Yeah, whether
right.
you know the age
well, no,
of
no,
your child.
Five of them. I don't know the age. Women know the age of the when they gave birth, but I just.
Okay, but
she's
yeah,
about 35 or 30. Let's see, Devin's 30.
Okay, that'll keep him busy. One of the things, in addition to protest songs and the Bleep the Army chant and all of that stuff, the wonderful music that Joe is responsible for and connected with. Another thing that he does with great regularity, and I don't know how well known this is to promote other artists, especially artists that may not be known yet. And on that stage at the Berkeley Barb 50th anniversary, there were a couple of performers that you had brought,
mm-hmm.
and one of them knocked everybody's socks off, and I jumped up as soon as she came off the stage and said, I've got to come on the radio. So she came. I'm happy to say her name is Emily Yates. She's here. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
And she was, I hadn't heard of her before, but which I should have, actually, because she's been performing for a while. But she is an Iraq war vet, and it was stunning when you asked for any vets in the audience to raise their hands, and no one did.
If no, Joe I saw there were like four of us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you couldn't
okay.
see
Joe's
because of the lighting.
Right, I couldn't
see. You weren't
see
the only
there.
Vet there.
Okay, I couldn't see all the hands raised there. It was kind of dark. But
well, she's a veteran.
Maybe I should have felt the veteran vibes in the room.
You were the only woman vet there. If that, there you go.
That does actually.
And you were in for 6 years, which is not just, you know, what during the Vietnam era, it's as short as you can be, you know.
Well, I actually, even though I was in for 6 years, that was the shortest amount of time I could have been in.
Wow.
Because I initially, when I enlisted, I was told that in order to get the job I wanted, which was public affairs, a journalist, as I thought, I had to sign up for 5 years. So I signed up for 5 years, and then as 5 years, 4.5 years was coming around, the stop-loss policy went into effect. I was
Remind
in,
me.
The stop-loss policy is when the government can actually keep people in past the end of their contract up to, indefinitely to the needs of the military. And if you refuse, then it's just like you went AWOL or anything else. So you have to just sort of do it. We used to call it the backdoor draft.
Yeah.
And so I was in for an extra year. That instead of getting out in June of 2007, I deployed in March of 2007. And came back in May of 2008 and then got out. And then moved to California. Woohoo!
Well, and you moved into music, which you hadn't done before.
Right. I didn't play any instruments. I was arrhythmic. I had to go to Africa to get rhythm, actually. I went and took a few drum... Incidentally, I didn't intend to go to Africa and get some rhythm. I wasn't that kind of tourist. I just went because my husband's bandmate had decided to go to Ghana and make an album with some friends, including my husband. And it was during the time of our honeymoon. And I was like, all right, well, we were going to be on our honeymoon. But if you want to go, I guess we could go to Ghana. Too.
Yeah,
so,
well, that sounds like a honeymoon to me.
It was really interesting, and we did some drumming workshops, and during the drumming workshops, 4 days, I got some rhythm somehow, and I came back and I picked up the ukulele that Eric, my husband, had attempted to teach me some chords on a few years before. And I was like, oh, I can strum now. Neat. and I started putting my opinions into my melodies.
She was billed at the 50th anniversary of the Berklee Barb as an expert in the ukulele.
I don't know if I'm an expert in the ukulele, but I use the ukulele as a vehicle for my opinions and my writing.
And the writing and the music, the lyrics, everything about it are killer. They're very... She started off with the song saying, okay, I learned and you know, while I was studying this music and just sort of absorbing stuff that you can say anything you want so long as you say it in a major key. And then people think, oh, happy, happy, and they hear you. It's which was a very interesting observation, and she then went on to prove her point with several songs that were very hardcore from this young woman, shall we say.
And Joe thought I was being Emily Yates light that night. He's like, you didn't play the porn song. I don't know why you didn't. And I said, I'm not going to play it on the air, but it's true.
Well,
I was tempering it.
Since instead of me talking about what you do, maybe you should do some.
Oh, do have an ukulele here.
Okay, good. And while you're getting that ready, I want to ask Joe, so where did you meet this young woman?
Well, people in the vets community have been telling me about her, and I went online a year or so ago and listened to YouTube. She has some YouTubes up there. The YouTube is quite an interesting phenomenon in our day today. YouTube,
yeah,
lots of YouTube
for
stuff
for performers of all
for all kinds of things. You can, fixing your car, making a guiche, everything's on YouTube, and And then, just kind of one thing led to another. People saying, check her out, whatever. And I keep trying to retire. I've been trying to do that for the past 3 years, and I haven't successfully done it yet. Anyway, so one thing, and then she said to be on the protest festival. And so there was a mix-up, whatever. She's on the protest festival. Oh. But then the people of the Berklee Barb event started kvetching about the fact that there's no woman. We don't have any women.
Hello.
It's
entertainers.
True.
You were there, but you were a talking head. So
thank you.
Anyway, and yes, I mean yes. In many levels, a talking head. I get it.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, so I said, well, I know this Emily Yates. Bring her in there. And Emily said, yeah, bring me in there. And then you saw her, and here we are today.
Yay. Excellent. Okay, so what are you going to sing?
Well, why don't I play this little tune that I wrote that was, it's called I Miss You. And I won't introduce it any further than that, since you've already said a lot about me, my military experience, and where I developed many of my opinions. So this is a song that I played the other night at the Barb, and I will play it again. Well, you broke my heart like Barack broke his campaign promises. You got out fast like he said he'd get us out of Iraq.
to you. Like Obama left Guantanamo open too. You both threw me off track, but I still voted both of you back. 'Cause I miss you like American bombs miss their targets. And I need you like the politicians need the press. But I hate you like I hate the establishment. So there's something that I must ask. Please don't make me have to start a revolution all over your ass. That's not one of the seven dirty words, right?
I hope not. I don't think so.
I don't think so. Folk music. You dropped into my life the way our infantry dropped into Baghdad. You stuck around for a while like we stuck around Afghanistan. But you were always so attentive to me every day, just like the FBI and the NSA. But one day you stopped treating me right. Oh, if only you had had some oversight. 'Cause I miss you like American bombs miss their targets. And I need you like the politicians need the press. But I hate you like I hate the establishment. So there's something that I must ask. Please don't make me have to start a revolution all over your... Hey, you want to sing along? 'Cause I miss you like American bombs miss their targets. Yay. And I need you like the politicians need the press. But I hate you. But I hate you like I hate the establishment. So there's something that I must ask. Please don't make me have to start a revolution all over your ass. Please don't make me have to start a revolution all over your ass. Oh, man.
Good. We all went to church at this job.
We did. Thank you.
We are going to move right along and talk to William Farley, but where is she on? Well, you are at Emily Yates.
Emily Yates does everything.com or EmilyYatesMusic.com if you have a shorter attention span.
And she's got CDs, she's got stickers, she's got everything, you know, t-shirts, and she's got sentence that you're on parole for.
I'm on probation.
You're on
slightly
probation.
Different.
Yeah. This was she was performing in an area which turns out wasn't the designated free speech area and ended up with eight officers holding her down on the ground, and she was charged with assaulting them, and she was convicted.
Because America. But luckily, I'm white, and they didn't shoot me instead of just throwing me in federal detention for 3 days and then charging me and then convicting me and putting me on probation. Luckily, it's not a violation of my probation to sing and talk about what happened, but it is a violation of my probation for me to be anywhere near the Liberty Bell. So let's put that in our freedom pipes and smoke it.
Well, I'm glad that that's an easier limitation than that. Anyway,
but
you can
thanks,
read
all, yeah. Thanks. It's Y-A-T-E-S.
Thank
Yates.
You.
Thank
and
you,
can,
Joe.
And you can check all of that story out on her website, EmilyYatesMusic.com or EmilyYatesDoesEverything.com, because she hasn't even gotten out the banjo yet. Which
so, thanks to her little song there, I want to recite a poem that I wrote. It's not a protest exactly. Years from now, no matter what may happen to the world or to us, we can thank God for our good luck. We lived in the age of Kim K's butt.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen,
leading the way.
Check it out at Cedar and Bonita tomorrow, 10 to 10 a.m. to p.m., the protest festival. Country Joe McDonald, Emily Yates, many, many blessings. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much.
We'll do it longer next time. Next up, William Farley. I'm going to go grab him right now. Joining me in studio, one of my favorite people, although I see him like once every, 4 years, 5 years?
Yeah, we're ships passing in the night, yes.
And the first time was, what was the occasion? Was it your first film or an art exhibit? It could have been anything. Anyway, it was the 70s. That's all I remember.
It was probably a screening of a film, but I must say I'm totally blanked out of the memory is... I feel like you let memory go so you have room for the new things.
Good for you. I love your story. You can go online, actually, to Bill's website, which is...
Well, I actually think Plastic Man has more...
Okay,
Jerry Ross Barish, Plastic Man, has its own website. I do have one at Farley Film, but I think in this film in particular, it's most best represented at the Plastic Man website.
Okay, so Bill Farley, our guest in studio, started out working in a shipyard, as has his brother and his father, and then by some, you call it a miracle, you'd always done little drawings, and your mother showed them to someone who knew about these things and said, you know, this guy, you should send your son to art school. He's very talented. And that was the end of the shipyards and the beginning of this life that you found, which is very different from where you began.
Yeah, when my mother mentioned that she showed my work to an artist, I didn't know she found an artist. I had never taken an art class, so this was totally foreign. But it was like when I thought about it, I was working in a factory rigging steel, and it was really hot, and I didn't like it. But when I thought about it, and the idea that I could do something else, it was almost like being paroled from jail. I mean, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I did know that I didn't like what I was doing. And I've had the great fortune to find people who mentored me. Sometimes it wasn't obvious. People saw that I might have the potential to be an artist, and they encouraged me in the most interesting ways. Not a direct confrontation, but it was enough inspiration to allow me to forge forward. And I'm really grateful for those angels who appeared in my life.
Yeah, from working class, somewhere in Massachusetts, Irish.
Yeah, one side of the family, my grandparents, my father's mother and father were from Ireland. My mother, her father is from Scotland, and then her mother was a Yankee, you know, not on the Mayflower, and certainly not of the class that held on to any money, but she was a very old New Englander.
But so you started out and you were studying a commercial illustration because working class, this has got to be a job. This is a job, not just a hobby.
Precisely.
And then you sort of got attracted to sculpture and painting, and you were doing all of that stuff, but then film came along.
So I came out to graduate school at CCAC as a sculptor, and at one point sculptors are starting to do videotape using video porta packs. And but I had a story that I made up, and I had a film class. In graduate school, you have electives, and I took this film history class, and the professor said, you know, you can either write a paper about what I showed you, or you can make a film. And I was very cavalier. I mean, I had never made a film before. I had no idea how to make a film.
But God forbid you should have to write a paper.
You nailed it. So I threw caution to the wind, and I made this film, and I remember it showing at the Monterey Film Festival, and when I saw 500 people laughing at what I thought was funny, I was hooked. There was no going back. And once again, it was my great good fortune that my advisor in the graduate program said, well, you know, every time you finish a sculpture, you're doing conceptual art, and every time you finish a piece, you have to start at the beginning. So maybe this storytelling is a better fit for you. And I come out of a storytelling family. I mean, I recall
so
as a kid.
There's the connection, yeah.
As a kid in the kitchen at my house after the main holiday dinner, at nighttime they'd come over and have sandwiches, turkey sandwiches. And I remember that they told great stories about, and they were always the blunt of the story. You know, it was always the terrible things that they did. But it was so entertaining. I recall that one year, I bought one of those ashtrays that was supposed to absorb smoke, because the kitchen was like a fog, because everyone was smoking. My eyes would be burning, but I didn't want to leave because the stories were so good. So I think I'm part of a tradition of storytelling, and that's
fine
the
Irish
path.
Tradition, among other things.
Yeah, all of them were good storytellers. Mm-hmm. All of them were good storytellers.
Tell some of the films you've made, and then we'll get to this one.
Well, there's two kinds of films. Ones that have kind of landed in my lap, stories that have landed in my lap, and others that I've developed. The first film that I made out of graduate school was called Sea Space, and I'd been working on a merchant ship in the South China Sea. And I was on the bow of the ship on lookout, and I had a little $50 tape, Sony tape recorder, cassette recorder, and I had been talking letters to friends, and this fellow came up to me, one of the fellow mates, and told the story about the ship he was on hitting a fishing boat, a Korean fishing boat, and sinking it. And they didn't go back and look for survivors. It happened to the wee hours. So we did this confession, and I came back and I realized that this was a story, and that film has shown all over the world and won prizes. So I started off with a wonderful success, and have continued to explore it. My work is really about this curiosity that I have. I really am always interested in why. What are the reasons? And in fact, this morphs right into Plastic Man, because with Jerry, I really want to know what's driving this guy. Why is he doing this?
Okay, so here we go to Plastic Man, which is Jerry Ross Barish. And in fact, you all have a good deal in common, your backgrounds and the variety they're from, and coming from working class families and trying to figure out how to turn what you are drawn to doing into making money. And in his case, he took a sideline, which is namely bail bondsman, which he was very successful and very progressive. If it weren't for him, lots of folks in the protests of the 60s and et cetera against the war and against racism would have been stuck in jail forever. He gathered the funds together and released them. And some of those folks are in this film thanking Jerry, which he had to, sooner or later, that business got swallowed up by commercial interests. So he's now devoting himself to his art, which... How did he wander into art? It's such a wonderful film. I just love it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think, once again, Jerry's life has been rather serendipitous as well. I mean, I always knew that he had stepped up at a moment in the civil rights moment, and he bailed out a whole bunch of people in San Francisco. I mean, 700 people without collateral. And what he accomplished in doing that was that those people went right back in the picket line, and they won that battle. that anti-discrimination battle. So he had his moment in the sun, so to speak. And yet I think there was part of himself that wasn't being served in this business. And he started to explore, maybe he was an artist, maybe he had something in him. And that journey is, deeply felt by him, and I think it's conveyed in the film that for many reasons that he was exploring this creativity and also trying to become more visible in the world.
Yeah, he wants recognition, and some of that is because of his own background. He talks about his dad and the boxing, and which he also did, and mafia connections on his father's part, and also he talks some about being Jewish and how his dad and the folks that he hung around with were tough Jews. And
well, I remember the first interview I did with his mother. She was in her 90s at the time.
It's so wonderful to have his mother in.
Yeah,
there.
She was wonderful. Jean was a wonderful person and a really good storyteller as well. And she said that, well, Jerry's father, Benny, said that Jerry was never a fighter. He was a lover. And, you know, in a way, that's a kind of a strange compliment. I mean, in that, it means you're an outsider in this family. But I think it gave him permission to go out in the world. And you can see that his father's influence and his father's prominence, his father was a fixer. His father could fix anything and was definitely in the underworld. So his father was prominent. His father was known by everybody. He was a personality. He was a Damon Runyon kind of guys and dolls kind of person. And I think Jerry felt always under the prominence of this man. And I think
the
it
shadow.
Is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it inspired him to see if he'd become visible, as visible as his father. Yeah.
So the film, we're talking about the film Plastic Man, the latest documentary, and we're going to be out of time all too soon, by our guest, Bill Farley. So tell people where they can see it, first of all, before we...
Well, it opens at the Roxy next Friday, the 21st, and it's running for a week there. And then it moves to the San Rafael Film Center for the Thursday the 27th and Sunday the 30th, all in August.
I'd love to see it on the big screen.
Yeah, it's fun to see it on the big screen. Yeah. I also want to say this is... probably one of the most wonderful collaborations I've ever been involved with. Janice Plotkin is her first movie as a producer. She's the co-creator of the first Jewish film festival in the world, and it's the first time she took on producing. And all of my collaborators, Richard Levine is an editor who I've worked with several films. Adam Kecker created the spine of the storytelling. Mm-hmm. Beth Custer did an amazing job.
Oh, yes, I wanted to mention that. The music is so cool.
She just nailed it. She just nailed what part of what Jerry was, bass clarinet, and wow. She just got it.
And Jerry is such a character, not that Bill isn't, but that's why I felt like you guys, some kind of kindred spirit thing is going on. And the film opens with this music, the bass clarinet, and he's walking along the shore picking up not rocks, not shells, not seaweed. He's picking up plastic. And he is not picking up any plastic. Some stuff he's not interested in, he throws it back. He's looking for plastic that looks like it's talking to him about something. And then he takes it back to his workshop, and he makes these incredible sculptures. And he has a great deal of difficulty getting any gallery to or any art entity to accept him because it's plastic.
The material is the lowest material you could work with. It's just, it's abandoned. No one has any use for it.
And this is so typical of him that he just sticks with it.
Right.
You know, like, this is what I do, thank you. He does wander into bronze a little bit at the end there. Anyway, a lovely story, and it's not over. That's the other thing. You definitely can tell that this is an ongoing story.
Right.
So, we're Plastic Man dot something?
Jerry Ross Barish, that will get you there.
Okay.
And, I'm sorry. I think that's the best route.
Okay. Jerry Ross Barish, Barrish. Bill Farley, our guest in the studio. Many thanks to you. And many thanks to Erica Bridgman at the controls. And have a good weekend. I'll see you tomorrow morning on the talkies. Bye.
Friday, August 14th at 7 o'clock p.m. You are invited to join us on Full Circle for a show about nothing. Full Circle is a cultural affairs radio magazine, and we're living up to the name. Our eclectic team of producers are preparing for your listening pleasure, a show that has a little something for everyone. Tune in for an analysis of soap operas through Storytime with JC, an exploration of the San Francisco Bay River Delta with Sam Alexander, an audio portrait by Vika Aronson, and all of the facts you didn't know with Josiah Luis. So join us on Full Circle as we present The Show With No Theme live on Friday, August 14th. Full Circle is produced by the First Voice Media Apprentices and airs live.